step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. Imagine growing up in the same neighborhood as one of the most notorious crime bosses of this century and becoming an FBI agent. What are the chances some of your friends might end up on the wrong side of the tracks, as they say? Well, then you've got an idea of what you will find in Jason Randazzo's book, Just Another Day. He had a lot of friends that had contact and later became involved in the wheelings and dealings of a guy named John Gotti, who took out Paul Castellano in a hail of gunfire at Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan to become the don of the Gambino crime family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it all culminated, I guess, in that well-known hit of Paul Castellano in 1985 when John Gotti took over. A lot of drama going on behind the scenes. He was the big man from the rest of the 80s into the 90s.
Yes. And then Bruce Cutler, his attorney, he was the Teflon Don, man. You could not put him away.
No. As was found out later on, the defense didn't use all the most, I guess, honest means to get either hung juries or acquittals, but they did what they knew best. And they couldn't get him. I think it was the third or fourth try before he was finally convicted. I spent 33 years in law enforcement. Actually, the inspiration for my memoirs began when I started to write down some stories more than 20 years ago about the people I was talking about, who I was raised with in that neighborhood in Queens. And I had told a few of the stories with some friends that I met in the Hamptons. And from their astounding reaction to my stories, it led me to want to memorialize those accounts just for posterity for myself. I was just thinking one day when I was in my rocking chair talking to, you know, the kids, I'd have some stories to tell them. But then as time went on, the number of stories grew. And then by the time I retired from the FBI, I looked and I saw that I had enough material that I could actually put it in a book. So my stories pretty much encapsulate those friendships and associations with the people who fell on both sides of the law. Beginning with the times I was taking public transportation with the other guys and girls from the neighborhood to the NYPD Academy in Manhattan, to later on seeing other guys and girls, mostly guys, being escorted into Central Booking in handcuffs. So after I moved on to becoming an FBI agent, the game intensified a bit with a childhood friend of mine who I met playing Little League Baseball and who I kept in touch with intermittently through the years, especially when we played against each other at rival high schools. And then he went on to become the right-hand man to the boss of the Gambino crime family, John Gotti Jr. So, yeah.
Does he know you wound up with the FBI?
Oh, yeah. I have a number of stories in my book about our meetings, both clandestine and otherwise.
He turned out to be an informant for you?
No, and that was one of the things. It was fun because my first office was actually in California, from the FBI Academy, and I had grown tired of being in New York. I was a cop here, and I just wanted to get out. I was 27 at the time, and due to some circumstances, I decided I wanted to come back to New York, but my one real issue with coming back was I was just hoping not to land on an organized crime squad that would be investigating the Gambino crime family and that friend. I just didn't want to use my friendship with him I knew him, his family, his uncle was our coach. Yeah, and I just didn't want it to devolve into a relationship where I was using him, so to speak. And it never actually came to that officially, but as I write in the book, we did have, a pseudo-professional relationship, but one in which I was more trying to help him get through the experience after he was finally caught in Brazil and brought back to the United States to testify against John Gotti Jr. Yeah, it was an interesting experience, both, I guess, for him and me. But he seems to be doing well. I mean, when he first came out, I was trying to help him out a bit because obviously he couldn't get a job just anywhere. So, I was trying to help him find employment. I even took him to arrange the game at the Garden because I was a longtime season subscription holder. And it was tough for him. I mean, he had a family, he had children, and just trying to find places to keep them safe and, you know, just try and get somewhat of a normal life really wasn't easy for him.
So he didn't end up in witness protection?
No, he's out there. He's today. I mean, he wrote a book. And
who are we talking about?
Oh, his name's John A. Light. He's got a book and he's out there and he's a motivational speaker. And as a matter of fact, if you watch certain mobster stories on TV, on Reels or other channels, he's on there talking about the way it was back then when he was part of the crew. Yeah, so he's not hiding anymore.
And neither are you, Jason. I think you got a true crime series here. Thank you. Todd Jen is a retired teacher in Texas, putting stuff on paper to see if anyone besides his wife and daughter will read it. His words, not mine. The inspiration for his book, his son, who was born with cystic fibrosis. It is entitled The Day's Not Over Yet, a CF Dad's Journal.
If you're not familiar with cystic fibrosis, I'll give you a little quick thing. It's a progressive disease, genetic disease. And, of course, we did not know he had cystic fibrosis. He was born in 1979, and you don't know that you are a carrier till you have a child with it. So he was going along pretty good at a young age, but the disease is so progressive, it really affects the lungs and the digestive system, and his lungs are constantly infected. When he got to about 12 years old, the hospital stays were just getting bad, and there's not anything else much to do, but they have started doing double lung transplants, but not in Texas. We actually got interviewed from Stanford, University of St. Louis, and Minnesota, and we ended up in University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to get evaluated. So I started doing a journal. Now, this actually happened in 1992. Close to 30 years. And I didn't look at the journal anymore. I did it on legal pads until a few months ago. My daughter found it and says, "What is this?" And I said, "Well, that's when we were up at North Carolina getting evaluated." And she said, "We need to put this out." So tell about a daily life of a CF kid. It's kind of what it started out to be. But as when we got up there, we started meeting people from all over the United States who were up there for the same thing. And I found out that we're not the only ones that go through battles. And it started out about what he and I put up with every day of what we were doing.
So he got a double lung transplant.
Yes, ma'am. At that time, he was the youngest one. And he actually made the decision. I told my son, "You're going to have to make this decision. I can't do this for you, but this is what's available." And he goes, "Well, if I don't do too good at it, they can learn on me." So he was that type of kid. He was a very funny kid. He got down to about 49 pounds, and he was probably a couple of days away from, is he going to make it or not? So the book's about the evaluation process and what we went through. He actually added 16 plus years to his life. And that was it was just amazing. He kept a journal. We didn't even know it. And my daughter found that one. And he's actually we've had that printed.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Make it count. So it's his version. It's pretty good. And so you get his version and then you get my version.
What a story. It takes a lot of guts to do that.
Oh, I tell you, people would say, "How did y'all do it?" I said, "Well, y'all didn't do anything. He did it all." I mean, he's the one that goes through it all. And all those kids go through that. Almost 30 years that things have changed. He was taking like 166 pills a day. And so you got to counter that for your liver and here and there. And they have learned a lot, doing transplants with cystic fibrosis kids. And they become young adults. And, it's helping out. Still not a cure. They're hoping that CF eventually will stand for cure found. but there's still not a cure. But yes, we do. We speak at groups. We've had book signings, book fairs, that type of thing.
Oh, keep it up, Todd. Thank you. Janet King retired from nursing as her elderly parents became more and more dependent on her. She says there's a lot of information out there about Alzheimer's and other diseases, but she believes her firsthand account will help others. The name of her book? We Didn't See It Coming.
You know, I looked at these commercials, like, did they forget how to brush their teeth or forget where their car keys were? You know, it was more about memory. And that is the easy part of Alzheimer's. And I don't think there's enough information out there to really warn people of what this is all about. With Mom, I think the worst one, I think, was I had a brother that was killed in a car accident in 1969. And for some reason, one night she just relived that. And she called me and said, Wade just died. And she was just, it was like it was happening all over again. I finally got her calmed down and then she forgot it the next day. But it was a horrible experience. The other time she called and they only lived two doors down from me. And she was just hysterical. There's a man in my bedroom. He's holding me hostage. And it was my dad. And he wasn't holding her hostage. But by the time I ran down there, she was just trembling. And my dad was just heartbroken because she didn't recognize that it was him. But then after she was put in a nursing home, then my dad really, somebody flipped a switch. He had been the perfect caretaker for her up until we had to put her in a nursing home. It was a side of my dad I had never seen. I mean, his whole being was directed at taking care of her. And Dad was an ordained General Baptist minister. And he had lived his faith all his life. And after Mom was put in a nursing home, he accused her of having affairs. He had called her names. He had accused me of trying to cover for her with her affairs. And I think one of the biggest things for me with the information that's out there is that, you know, they will tell you that their reality is their reality, but that doesn't really give a definition. When the reality is that Mom was sleeping with a nurse in the nursing home, that it was openly gay, and that was his reality. It was to the point that he had to call the sheriff's department to do an investigation. None of it was true. And then he had been talking to a lady that he had known as a teenager. Now, remember, Dad is like 90, and she was in Florida. And, you know, his mom got worse. He just kept wanting to go down and see her, which didn't really sit well with me. But I began to realize how lonely he really was. This is not a matter of choosing your battles. It's a matter of how you're going to cope with their reality. And the first few chapters, I introduce you to my family, because if you don't know the background of the loving Christian home that I was raised in, then you don't really understand what Dad was doing at the end. I focused a lot on this for Christian people, because sometimes they think gave up their salvation for everything. No, it's a disease. And making that distinction between a person and a disease is really hard. He looks like my dad. He walks like my dad. He talks like my dad. But I was dealing with a disease. And that's a tough one. But I did not write this book to make money. I will not profit. Once I've recouped my investment, then all the proceeds are going to go to the Ryan Blaney Family Foundation. And they focus on Alzheimer's and other brain disorders. We'll get this out there and hopefully make some money for some research. And maybe not so many people will have to go through this.
All right, Janet. Good for you. Thank you. Ever been to Pittsburgh? Well, you're about to get a taste of it in Joanne Neal's cookbook entitled Pittsburgh on Your Plate. It's a love story of the city she calls home.
My parents had passed away, and then my brother died suddenly. And I was left to deal with, you know, the house and everything. And I sat on the back deck with my mother's cookbook and my grandmother and my great aunt. And I thought I'd just put the recipes together for my kids. Had no vision at all about a book, nothing whatsoever. And then as I started to go through all their handwritten recipes, and it, you know, it just brought back so many memories. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll make this, you know, I'll put a little doodad above it, you know, about certain things, certain recipes and so forth. And then one thing led to another. And then I, you know, we love Pittsburgh. You know, it's an old soul. Pittsburgh's been around a long time. And the people have such history here and ancestry. And everyone is very ethnic. You know, if you go to something, it's not unusual to get a variety of ethnic foods. It's because it's what we eat. It's what we are. It's what we do. And people continue it traditions, like they go to churches and learn how to make pierogies. And by the end of it, you know, I wanted the book to be something that if you looked at it and you read it, there's some essays in there about Pittsburgh and the houses and the churches and the sports and so forth. I wanted to get a glimpse of what Pittsburgh was like. It's such a special place. And then the recipes that I had were, you know, so many of them were so special to me, and it just really sort of grew. And people helped me along the way, which was great fun. And I have a cousin who her husband is very Polish. His parents were right from Poland. And one day we were over there and we were having cabbage rolls. And she said to me, I said, these are really good cabbage rolls. And she said, yeah, you know, my mother-in-law always put a little bit of applesauce in. And I was like, oh my, can I use that recipe? So we did. We put Mike Bujakowski's mother's cabbage rolls in there because, you know, I'm not sure you would get that if you just looked up online. You know, that was from the old country. You know, that's what we wanted. And it's been an amazing adventure, just an amazing journey that I've just enjoyed every bit of it.
That's great. Well, that was a rough time for you, you know, probably helped you through your grief.
There was a lot of tears. The family house was down in Braddock, which is where everyone went at least once or twice a week. So the memories from that big Italian house with people coming in, you know, family came in the back door, but guests came in the front and rang the bell. And, you know, my brother and I, it was an adventure every time we went there, because we either went up in the attic or we went in the basement, which had like sub basements and another kitchen down there. And if you wanted to get there from outside, you had to go through this door that was like level with the grass, you know? So, you know, there were tears, you know, here and there. And especially when my brother passed, because no one expected him to just die. And so that was, you know, it sort of helped me through. So I've done several signings. We were in the newspaper. We were in the Tribune Review. They did a big article and we were in the local paper. I got calls from groups. I've done many speaking engagements. And people really enjoy that. You know, there's so many people that have the same stories that I do. I've gone to all the bookstores and we've done Facebook. It just has really grown and it's been selling every month. I have to tell you, there's several people that have children that have moved away. And two of them contacted me last April and she said to me, when I get really homesick, I open your book and it just makes me feel better. And the other girl wrote and said, I read it at night. And she said, I call it my delicious novel.
Joanne, what's better than that? Javier Ruiz is a retired cop living outside LA. He was inspired to write Sword of the Emperor, The Riders, after he took some classes in Roman and Greek history.
It's a Roman general and he worked for the emperor. And, you know, the emperor sends him to spots all over the empire whenever there's a problem. He's the one who goes strains it out. You know, and mostly he's going after criminals. He's fighting them. There's one slaver that he's going after and chases him across the desert in Persia, near Persia, and then captures him and is trying to bring him back to Rome for trial, but it's too hard to do so. He has the authority from the emperor to kill that, you know, at any time. So he ends up hanging him. So, you know, he goes around breaking up gangs and he's an expert with all weapons, expert horseman. If you want to imagine him as a modern day Texas Ranger, you know, that kind of person, except he has the authority to kill and take justice in his own hands. Gaius Galen.
Galen is the guy. He's the main character, and he saves the life of a general.
Right. That's, yeah, the general's the commander of, Galen's in the army. He's sent to what is now Germany, and they're fighting what they call the barbarians, which are the German people in those days. And they're trying to conquer them, to bring them under the Roman peace, the Pax Romana. It was Marcus Aurelius' idea, trying to put the whole world to get under one under the Roman rule, and there would simply be peace throughout the world. Because it doesn't work that way.
So he saves the emperor from an assassination attempt.
And then between the emperor and the general, they decide that he should be what the emperor calls a rider. And those are the men he sends out whenever there's a problem. And he has a group of men that are all special, specially trained, expert riders, expert fighters, but he also wants men that can think.
Well, in the next book, we're going to find out, what happens to Galen.
Yeah, well, in the next book, it's just more of his adventures, and he's riding around doing a lot of work for the emperor, and he gets into, he makes an enemy of the emperor's son. So I think it's pretty interesting. I try to make it interesting, and I wrote it. Well, I've always been a fan of paperbacks. In fact, when I was in the Navy, I always had a paperback in my back pocket, and even after that, I always had a paperback with me. So I wrote it for the person who reads paperbacks.
All right, Javier, keep it up. Driving a truck for over 3 decades, 500 miles or more most days, got Pete Merrill thinking about his book, Moving America.
I just kind of want to make people aware that it's really demanding and a fragile system, our delivery system, and that's really what motivates me to do the book. It's not like my trucking stories. It's more about the industry and how it affects us all. And I hope it doesn't get any more disrupted than it is now with all these containers out there in the ocean. There aren't enough truckers to pull those things, those containers. I don't know what the kind of the politics of it is kind of an issue there, but it's all those containers out there in the ocean got to be put on a chassis of a trailer and delivered, Some go by rail, but eventually they get put on a truck. And this time of year, it's really kind of a tough issue to deal with,
When you say fragile, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's just so sensitive with logistics of it all, the scheduling, the controlling of shipments and freight and inventory, it can be disrupted by different issues or elements in our world, and the worst one I hate to think of would be a cyber problem, or there is a weather or fuel shortages, that kind of thing. Anything can disrupt it. A lot of highway construction, if you block up a highway interstate for say a half hour, or not to mention a couple of days, have you seen the kind of backup that causes on traffic these days? If that, you probably have in over there in the east. And that's just what I mean. If it goes along real smooth and undisturbed, it seems to be fine, but it's just that there's so many elements that could affected.
Well, you were talking about all the freight that's out there in the ocean and, waiting to be delivered, and we have supply chain issues. Is that a direct result of the pandemic, or is it politics?
Oh, I don't think it's so much pandemic. I think politics has a lot to do with it, but I think that with the regulations and of the government and fuel prices, and it all kind of can affect trucking companies and just the performance of every day. It's an important issue today, even more than it was a couple of years ago. I think we're seeing the results of how important the industry is, and how there's a shortage of drivers, and how it's already been disrupted by even the cost of fuel is gone up so high that it's starting to take effect. And I hope that stabilizes a little bit here soon. So
why is there a shortage of drivers, though?
They're hiring a lot of incompetent drivers, and inexperienced, and I just don't think they last. They cause more problems than they're worth, and I don't know why they can't attract better or good qualified drivers. The pay rate's gone up. good, and the incentives have been pretty good. And I don't think they get the respect from shippers, receivers. You know, it employs millions of people, not just in trucks, but I mean, it's warehousers and workers and all kinds of employees of the trucking companies. I mean, it's just, it should be, continue to be carefully maintained.
I think a lot of people would agree with that. All right. Imagine spending 12 hours a day inside a truck training drivers for 12 years. Joe Ward did it, and he lived to tell the stories in Just Joe, True Life Adventures of an American Truck Driver.
One of my coworkers did, me and another driver were sitting around in the office telling truck driving stories and stuff one day about crazy things, crazy drivers on the road or whatever that day. And one of the girls that was working in the office started laughing, said something about I told the best stories and that I'd been everywhere and seen everything it seemed like, and I should write a book. There's one story about a trainee that her and her husband were both in training at the same time. And she was kind of a crazy person running around talking about how they had a Rhode Island red rooster at home. Then she pops off and tells me that the neighbor's dog killed it.
Oh.
But they took it to the taxidermist and had it stuffed, and they were going to take it on the road with them when they got in their own truck. So they were going to be riding around the country with a dead chicken in the truck with them.
Fun. Wow. Why?
I know, right? That's just the kind of crazy peoples that you come across whenever you're a trainer, you know?
Okay, so is that the kind of person you have to be a successful truck driver?
A crazy person? Some people say so. Well, you know, it was written more like for entertainment purposes. It's not some big expose of the trucking industry or, you know, how bad it is or how good it is. It's just, you know, about entertainment. Truck drivers, we love telling our road stories, you know.
Do you take copies of your book on the road with you so you can hand them out or talk about them and sell them?
For a while, I took some on the truck with me, and I sold a few to some of the people at the truck stops around where I get fuel and stuff, and some of my coworkers and stuff like that. And then one of the managers at one of the truck drivers that I frequent quite often let me have a little book signing deal in their parking lot. And I sold like a half a dozen books that day. And I've had a few people that have bought the book that have asked me if I was going to write another one and have told me they would like to hear more stories. But like I told them, I've got to sell enough copies of this book to make sure that it's going to be financially feasible, you know?
Yes, I do, Joe. You want to sell those books, and you can check them out on Amazon, Apple, iTunes, or go to pagepublishing.com. You can see all of the books available to buy or download. If you missed anything, go to 710WOR.com and download the podcast. Really appreciate all of our authors, and we got more where they came from on the next Page Publishing Book Club. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.